Welcome to, now, not only are we on location, as we are have been the last few years, at the Hampton Film Festival. This is the 25th anniversary of the Hampton Film Festival.
The silver.
This is, are you ready for this? Drum roll, send out the horn. This is our 100th broadcast, podcast.
How have we done this for 100
around,
podcasts? How is that even
sitting
possible?
Sitting around talking movies. And the fact
we're surrounded now with tons and tons of celebrities and stars and filmmakers.
And just and it's interesting, I mean, that we're on location at a special event for our special event.
Right.
100th,
this is the 1770 House. We're in East Hampton. And let's dive right in and meet some of the folks we're talking to.
So anyway, as always, it's okay. Neil Rosen here with Bill Regoli.
or not.
Okay.
And I'm Bill McCuddy. So here we are, as Neil said, and we're tableside, and let's bring in our first guest.
So we're sitting here with Jamie Block, who is one of the stars of the movie The Misogynist, as well as the writer director of the film, Owner Turkel. Am I pronouncing
it? Tukel. Everyone says Turkel. Turkel, but yeah,
there's no R.
Are you Studs?
Like
Studs' son?
No, but
and you just took the R out.
In my younger days, I was referred to as a stud quite a bit, but not.
Thus
not
the misogynist.
I can see how that would have been a long time ago.
This movie was really funny. I mean, I could tell you the premise, but why don't you?
It's about two Trump supporters in a hotel room on election night. They're partying their asses off, and Jamie Block, you can keep going if you want.
Well, it's election night. It's set in one night, a very historic and important night that everybody remembers, and Orner was able to...
Well, we have to go into it.
Okay,
tell what it was about.
And,
right.
And different characters, a different cast of characters.
We should say different people remember it for different reasons.
Right.
It started out being a good night for some people and ended up being...
Sort of, but I don't know that your character is necessarily and I don't think I'm doing a spoiler here, because very early on I'm saying to myself, is this guy really a Trump supporter, or is he just being, complacent to his buddy Dylan Baker?
Point.
You know,
I think that in
we know
probably,
we know his
probably,
wife is
can
not
I just
a
say,
Trump supporter.
Probably Neil's first excellent point since we've been doing it. And we should tell you also, this is our 100th podcast,
oh, well,
so we are
really
very,
well.
Very excited to have
an
you.
Honor to be here.
Assuming that this makes the podcast, of
yes,
course.
Yes, that's right.
No, you're on. You're definitely
on. We know his wife isn't. You know,
Baxter, depending, he represents a certain category of males in the country, which I believe in. I didn't write this. I want Orner to ultimately be the last word on this, but to my mind, he represents a certain percentage of the male population, which might be a large percentage, that depending on who they're talking to is who they vote for. If they're talking to women, they voted for a certain person. If they're talking to men or their boss, and yes,
he's a bullshitter.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's
and
a
he needs,
like
and
that.
he's being controlled by women and by his boss, and he's lost his balls.
Hey, listen, there's a whole bunch of people in this country who didn't vote for Trump until the day after he won. Then they were like, yeah, that was me. I was in.
Now, seeing this, you know, and again, I loved it. It was hysterically funny. And it also makes some very interesting points because, you know, a lot of people have been trying to get in. I mean, living in New York and even the Northeast, there's a whole mindset of, like, who would vote for this guy? And I think the opening 20 minutes when you hear Dylan Baker's rant about anybody but her, you know, it's not about voting for him. I think there's some very interesting points about getting into the mindset of people that voted for Donald Trump. And I don't know where you stand politically, although I think the leanings, it's more like a Colbert Report kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. We were just trying to, like, be ironic by showing the behavior of the conservatives without really taking the conservative side. That's kind of the idea. But at the same time, I think the liberals created Trump as much as the conservatives did, because you're right. Like they said, people defend liberal policies, and they're against Trump in a lot of ways. The people who come in and defend, they are against Trump in the movie. The people who come in and out, who are the antithetical political viewpoints to the conservatives, they come in, they say one thing, but at the end of the day, you realize they didn't even vote for Hillary either. That was kind of the point, which is we can, after the election, people were like very political, and yes, the liberal policies, progressive policies are good, but where were they when Hillary got elected? People weren't, I mean, overall, right. There was an overwhelming enthusiasm. I did vote for Hillary, and I was excited about having a woman president, but I was never.
Do you have daughters?
No, I don't have daughters. Okay. I don't have any children. But I wasn't enthusiastic like I may have been for Obama when it was Obama against McCain, and definitely.
Did you
Sarah
talk
Palin.
To Trump's a lot of to get into the mindset of the Dylan Baker character and even your character? Although Dylan is spewing forth all this stuff on like why he you know, why it's great that Trump won. Did you talk to a lot of like Trump
supporters? I'm from North Carolina. I mean, I've been in New York for 7 years, but I come from a socially progressive but conservative, very conservative, fiscally conservative region, North Carolina, which is the coolest kind of redneck Republicans you've ever met in your life. I am one.
You have cigarettes and coal mines there. That's so Trump. Right. It's scary.
But I'm from a small town, and I've been around, you know, small town conservatives my whole life. So I think that's part of my cultural DNA in a way as well. So when Trump won, I was angry at the country, and I thought, well, we all have to share responsibility. But I haven't been happy with the way people have treated Trump.
But how did you come up with, I mean, you wrote this, that these misogynistic, it's called the misogynist, this misogynistic rants that Dylan goes on, not only in the beginning on Trump, but without giving too much away, there's a whole rant towards the end of the film on his views on women and, and you know, like where did you come up with this?
I've worked with Orner in a couple films now and a lot of projects, and that is one of the geniuses of Orner. I mean, it is a situation where, you know, you'd think someone would have to go out and do research and do interviews. Orner goes back behind back behind a curtain, and he emerges with a script, and then he goes, and we none of us really know completely where it comes from. It comes from his mind, but you're right. I mean, what's amazing to me about this film right from the beginning was, you know, it's an equal opportunity exposer of hypocrisy, whether you're left, whether you're in the middle or on the right, and it all came from his mind, and it was funny at the same time. So that's why we all
That's Trump in a nutshell. We don't know where he's getting this stuff. He goes behind a curtain, he comes out, and he's got all these ideas. Let me ask you about the possibility of this. We're here at the Hamptons Film Festival. Has it been picked up? Do we have a distributor?
We're hopefully roll this out slowly. You know, we considered kind of.
Do we have a distributor?
Not yet.
That's what I just said.
Use the word distributor.
What's it like to watch this with an audience?
Last time was the first audience we had, and it was. Wow. I never enjoy the first time. You know what I mean? Like watching it. If there's not a laugh, I feel like it's not working. If there's a walkout, I feel like they're not going to the bathroom. They're disturbed and they hate the movie.
There were
four or five walkouts.
There were two that we thought were walkouts, and they showed up.
No, there were
again.
A few people that walked out that came back in, but there were. I counted
but that's
four.
Not a walkout if they come. No,
was
there
Rudy Giuliani one of your walkouts?
I think he would really enjoy this movie.
He's here. I watched a movie with him last night. What about a Trump?
What movie did you watch with him last night?
The Christopher Robin movie.
Oh yeah, was it a good?
He bald like a little bitch.
He did.
Oh good.
Yeah. He carries a poo bear with him. Piglet. I think it's Piglet he carries around.
He's big on poo. I'll say that. So wait. So let me just. What about getting this in the White House? What about calling Trump?
Trump to see it. And I think that a lot of Trump supporters will actually like the movie. A lot of people came up to us last night and said, we thought the movie was just going to bash Trump the whole time, and it really does kind of have both sides, you know? I mean, the liberals have not been innocent since the election. I mean, if you think about the Twitter universe and the way everyone's just bombastically going after Trump on Twitter. If you've ever been harassed on Twitter, it's a terrible experience to be inundated by all these terrible nuclear tweets that are telling you how awful you are. And I'm just saying...
Neil knows that pain.
Well, I mean, it's irresponsible. And I think, like, I don't know. The president, even though
we feel sorry for him. He's attacked.
But he's attacked from the very beginning. But he won. He beat 15 Republican nominees. He beat the media. He beat a president that people thought couldn't be a candidate they thought couldn't be beat, and he did all these things. He was still treated like a loser the day after the election, even, you know?
A couple of quick things. Some of these, your character is kind of like talked into doing a lot of things by Dylan. Tell me about those scenes with Dylan. I mean, some of these monologues are like 5 minute monologues.
Well, first of all, let me say, working with Dylan Baker, it was one of the most amazing experiences of my life. What a pro!
We don't care about that.
Get to the monument. What about doing the scenes and that?
Yeah, he's like going on these 5 minute monologue rants. You know, like you know,
with lots of drugs and booze. Yeah, it was. You know, it was.
What were you snorting there? Was it baking soda?
Yeah, and also a little bit of real Coke, too. Yeah, but I mean,
so you're
messing.
That's what we're doing. It's the same stuff you're doing right now. That was left over from Neil the Stuffer's doing right now.
And the sex scenes are real, too. I mean, you know.
You're a method actor.
The only ones with Dylan are real. The ones with the women are not real sex, but the ones with, so anyway.
Well, it was a lot.
So bring the kids is what you're saying. This is a movie for the whole family.
You haven't seen it, though.
I haven't. Neil saw it.
Neil, you saw it last night. You watched it 1 a.m?
Well, I'm a late night guy.
Okay.
I mean, so I don't even go to
bed. That was lunchtime for him.
It was perfect. I mean,
on your headphones with headphones on, or just watching the?
No,
Computer screen? Or?
No, computer through the TV. I was full blown.
Oh, wow, that's great.
Like Apple TV through the TV.
Any weak link? What was some weak link?
How did it sound?
Did it sound great?
It looked great.
Okay.
I love the two women who played the...
oh, they're wonderful.
Did you see that coming? Did you see the shift in perspective coming halfway through? So you liked it when
Here's what happened. I saw, without giving much away. There's a bit with an iPhone where I saw that coming.
Yeah, yeah.
But I did not.
But it was rewarding when that happened, right? Because the audience.
But
loved
I did
that,
not I see the outcome with those women.
No, okay.
I did not see that coming.
It's kind of the same outcome though as what happens with Alice, which is kind of like cheap. But I feel like it does kind of work, maybe. By the skin.
But nobody
of the
knows what we're talking about.
Yeah. So is right, Dylan? Right. So I'm then the perfect person to ask. Is Dylan the sort of Larry David if he was for Trump kind of?
Yeah, he doesn't have any of the kind of cowardly affability. I guess that Larry David has. He is very shrill, very kind of obnoxious, very coarse in his delivery. Wouldn't you say Dylan is? Until the end when it all falls apart and he's revealed for who he really is. He's just a lonely man going through a divorce. It's really about the pain. But I think the last half of the film is not even political.
Why is there a TV in this movie that is always running stuff backwards?
Well...
Is that a metaphorical?
It could be a metaphor. Are we going forward or backward with the election of Donald Trump? That was kind of the idea, the imagery, you know?
Well, in your honor, we're going to play this whole interview backwards.
Thank you for being here. Yeah.
I mean, don't you think also there's a little bit of an aspect of the supernatural? It's almost like a space odyssey. You know,
Ghost in the Machine
kind of thing.
Did this man really get elected? Did this really happen?
there's this element that changes the direction and the narrative of the movie, and very critically at the end, and we're not really sure how it works why it's there.
Well, also, just think about this technology right now that you have, our cell phones. Are they recording us or are they not? Sometimes you'll say something like, I'm thinking about having a Krispy Kreme donut, and then you're getting a Krispy Kreme donut ad on your phone a couple of hours later. So are these things recording us right now? And the idea is that technology having a mind of its own, so that TV pops on its own, pops on and off on its own, distracting everyone, pulling everyone out of the reality.
Changes the course of history.
I could see this as a stage play. Did you originally think?
No, I never.
Did you workshop it at all that way?
No, we actually are thinking about approaching people to possibly put it on stage if it's
I mean, if you think about it, it's a hotel room.
Yeah.
And with the girls, it's just like you could.
That's easy to get do that. Outside
and the wife opposite, right? So it would really work.
What he really wants to do is produce. He's ready to take your show on the road.
So you're a film critic, Norm. That's what you've been doing for 30 years, right?
Yeah.
And then are you going to go into a second phase? Are you going to stay with film criticism? This podcast.
Give him a role.
You would be obviously you've acted in films before. I've seen you in something.
Yeah,
haven't
you saw me in Top 5, the Chris Rock.
Oh, you were in that, right? But you've been in other stuff even before that.
Yeah,
right?
I was in a couple of other things. Yeah, so you want to cast me in something?
I would cast you in something. Sure, I'm doing.
Whoa! We're a team.
Are you in New York or are you in the East?
I'm in New York.
For me, it's like about having a good attitude. And obviously, you guys are not introverts, so you'd have you'd be hands in front of the
camera.
We'll
give you all the.
You have good looks. You have good looks. Handsome, but not like George Clooney handsome in a different kind of way.
I respect that you think I have good looks. I'm a little curious about why. I think Neil falls into that category, but we're available. This is a podcast. We enjoy doing it, but who knows where
you
were.
You told me because we met at the opening night festival of the Hampton Film Festival, the opening night party, and you told me that you were a musician before you got into acting.
Right. I'm 49, so in my 20s and 30s, I was under the name Block or Jamie Block. I had a few records out on Capitol
Records. Was your band?
Yeah, yeah. And it was like a hip-hop folk kind of thing that... did a lot of touring and a lot of playing and then I have changed careers and this is like a new phase of what I've been doing creatively. I like this way better. You know why? Because when you go to a festival, you don't have to actually perform.
Like if you're music,
it was the scare. Performing at a festival is horrible because there's like buzzes on the stage and guitar strings.
So this is you. We're getting the real you right now.
Yeah.
So you're scared to perform.
Can I just get one hip hop folk song title?
Loser by Beck. Subterranean Homesick Blues by Bob Dylan in 1964 was really the first. No, but that's really the first. Well, a lot of people think that's actually the first rap song.
Mom is in the basement, faceful the black medicine, arm on the pavement.
Think about the government. Yeah. So,
you ever see the music video on that?
Yes, with who's the poet?
I don't know, but he keeps...
Allen Ginsberg,
right.
Cards with the lyrics. It's like one of the very original music videos. Bill, what do you want to ask, my friend?
I already asked it. I asked about seeing it with real people, which
seeing
is
it
always
with real
different.
People.
Brigoli is like Hitchcock. He makes one appearance in each interview.
I would say that... Listen, for folks who haven't seen it, when we were working on this...
Well, that's everybody listening.
Yeah, everybody listening. Oh, okay. So this is a script that when folks read it, They wanted to be in a movie, and some people read it and called at night and said, this is too much. I'm crying. This is so disturbing. I didn't sleep last night. I can't be in the movie. That happened on numerous occasions. And it all worked out for the best because we have the best cast. No, for real. It was all serendipitous. But when you're sitting in that movie theater for the very first time and some people get up, I'm like, wow, did we cross the line? Did we go too far?
Well, that should be in the trailer. What you just said should be in the trailer. We are so pleased that owner and Jamie thank you guys for coming by.
By the way, since it's a podcast, you can't see owner Turkell. Cross between, looks-wise, between Jerry Garcia meets a young Francis Coppola.
Oh, that's nice. I've also gotten Corey Feldman and Jim Belushi. So that's nice.
But you shot the Corey Feldman people, didn't you? Didn't you just pull a gun out at that point and say this is...
And Jamie, you can see...
I'd love to make a joke about that. It's hard to make a gun joke.
Well, we hope you get picked.
It is.
With that and talk about
you know why Trump's.
Neil, what did you say?
You know why Trump's never going to be assassinated? Because everyone with a gun loves him. So he's bulletproof.
Well, that joke's in the movie. You know, there's also there's so much to go. This is great, Neil. Thank you. And tell me your name again.
Bill McCuddy.
Bill McCuddy.
Thanks for
and Bill Bergoli. Like that's so. Listen, the four B's.
The movie is The Misogynist. We really hope it gets picked up. I didn't think it went, but to me, there's no boundaries. I mean, film is art, and. You know, it wasn't disturbing to me. I just thought it was just
yeah, it's supposed
funny.
To be funny.
But it's funny, but it's funny, and there's a lot underneath the funny. It's
when it becomes a stage production, he and I will do it at the Bethesda Holiday Inn in the Greater Washington D.C.
Bill, and Neil, thanks so much.
Thank you for joining us.
Thanks a lot. We're sitting here with Allison Chernick, who directed the documentary, which was the opening night selection at the 25th anniversary of the Hampton Film Festival this year, on the iconic violinist, some say perhaps the greatest violinist of our day, Itzhak Perlman. And the movie is called Itzhak, and welcome.
He's no Henny Youngman, but he was very, very good.
Thank you.
I don't know. Yasha Heifetz, maybe? I don't know. We could weigh it out there. What made you want to do a documentary on Itzhak Perlman and his whole life, which is a fascinating story? Please tell us a little bit about it, about him being Jewish and the whole... Fill us in a little bit on our audience.
All of that basically made me want to do this film. His the largeness of him and his personality and his life and the music and the Jewish factor, Jewish history, the love story between him and Toby, all of his passions. He's just such an incredible character. And as a filmmaker and a documentarian, I saw that pretty clearly.
So what kind of approach did you want to take to make it? Because you get music, get the personal story, and you don't want to lose one for the other.
Yeah, well, for me, the only approach is cinema verite, observational style. To me, that's the way that you capture somebody most organically and most naturally. So I wasn't thinking so much about interview style or narration or having people kind of talk about him. So for that style of filmmaking, he's also the perfect subject.
What is the most memorable thing that you learned about Itzhak Perlman after spending so much time with him and making this particular film?
He is a man with so much humanity and love in his heart that is infused into his music, and that beautiful sound that he creates is a product of his incredible heart and love and compassion in life, and obviously his resilience. Having overcome polio and all of his experiences in life and his connection to his family and all of that, for me, is what creates that sound.
I have to tell you that I didn't know that he had polio. I didn't know that everything I think I've seen about him, maybe on 60 Minutes or in performing over the years, I never saw him in a wheelchair.
Never knew that he was in a wheelchair?
No,
Really?
No, I don't have that. I
he
never had that concept
of it. Until about 10 years ago, he was on crutches.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah. And so, I wonder too about the access and what he didn't want to do. Was there anything you weren't allowed to do or go or be a part of?
Not really. I mean, it's funny. Toby, his wife, is incredibly instrumental and getting this film off the ground, but we joke and say, oh, his middle name is No, because he would say no to things, but very quickly right after he would say yes. And I
like
also,
what?
For example, playing...
Nude scenes?
Yeah, exactly. That was my goal. He played after the, after the opening night, he played, and at first when I called him, I said, do you want to play the composition right after? And he's like, no. And an hour later, he's like, sure. and it was just like that throughout the filming. It was sort of like, he would always say, this is going to end up on the editing room floor. Like, he doesn't exactly know that process of filmmaking. And so his first instinct was like, why? And then I'd be like, just do it. But really, it was mostly just capturing what was
naturally. Was there a lot of, are we done yet? Or do you need more? What do you mean, keep going?
Like, I was incredibly easy on him. Like, I wouldn't make him do anything that he wasn't sort of already doing. As I said, I just wanted it to be this sort of observational cinema verite style, so it wouldn't even be natural for me to make him do things.
It must have been great, you know, if you're filming this movie and spending a lot of time with him, you must have been privy to getting some private performances from Itzhak Perlman. Like, can you play that again?
Yeah.
Can you do that? Could you play that section of this score again?
Yeah,
you
that,
know,
what we would call pearls of wisdom.
Yeah. Well, you know, filming him in his living room with Evgeny Kissin and Misha Maisky and all these amazing collaborators that he worked with, Manny X, it was just tremendous and incredible to witness that. And then because it was rehearsal, they could stop and start and kibitz with each other and talk. And so you get the personality within that versus the onstage performances were more, controlled. Obviously, I couldn't even have my camera too close up. It was tricky with the microphone. So we really enjoyed the rehearsals.
Yeah, a couple old guys just sitting around playing is what it is, even though they're
in the living room, no less.
Yeah,
had the best time. Then they went downstairs, had their Chinese food, and then we ended up creating this, you know, scene back and forth that was really elegant.
How much time did it take you, like, start to finish, like, from inception to, like, finished product to do the film?
First year was the Medal of Freedom Award, and that was November of 2015, and then we were really done, like, 9 months later, because it's a year in the life, and then it sort of started again. But I would say in the fall we did, like, one or two shoot. So in the end, it was about a year of production, and it was about 9 months of editing.
And it's going where? It's pre-sold to
Masters came on PBS for a broadcast.
Great.
So we're going to show it like around March or April of 2018, and then we'll do a theatrical run and streaming as well. My sales agents are figuring.
And because we're at the Hamptons Film Festival, let me not let the moment pass without saying that he lives or has a place on Shelter Island.
East Hampton and a school, the Perlman Music Program.
Well, that's the school is what I was referring to.
That's
because people don't know that he runs a school over there.
Right.
Well, and that sort of comes out.
You don't know that.
You don't know.
Right.
Many people do know that.
It is his home.
And he's in a wheelchair. Yes, I don't know anything about that.
You don't know anything about this guy.
I need to see this movie.
I think you should see the movie, Bill.
It's his home away from home, so it couldn't have been a more perfect place to premiere, you know, for him. And
I think it's incredible that they opened the festival, the 25th anniversary of the festival, with a documentary.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, who does that?
They also said that it was the first in all 25 years that they had two spillover theaters.
Wow.
So there were more people.
Right, I know that you could go to Guildhall. There were two different theaters.
Were you surprised that it was selected to be the opening night film?
I wasn't surprised. I was super excited, though. But, I mean, I was
Did you know going in? Did you know?
No, I did not know going in, but I know he has so many fans out here, and I just knew it would be very warmly received, which it was, but even more so than I imagined, to be honest. The standing ovation was like 10. They wouldn't sit down.
Yeah, that's amazing.
They were
Congratulations. He's an amazing icon, as Neil said. I mean, and I think everybody needs to see this film because, it's a great story.
Thank you so much, you guys.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure meeting you.
Great to meet you.
Joining us again for the 25th anniversary is kind of a hometown tale, which I really like. Two guys who lived here are filmmakers and have made an interesting movie called Killer Bees. Orson and Ben Cummings, gentlemen, welcome to Sitting Around Talking Movies.
Thank you very much.
So this is interesting to me because I live within spitting distance of the Bridgehampton High School and was very upset that I wasn't invited over during the craft services or any of the kind of shooting schedule that you had there. But
low budget documentaries, you would not be happy with what you found.
This is a great story. We live in the Hamptons. There's lots of wealth here, as the movie points out. But there are also people who work and live here who are not wealthy. And this small high school has an amazing basketball team. No less than Shaquille O'Neal decided to executive produce this thing, and this is kind of your debut. So welcome back home to the Hamptons, and welcome to show business. How's it going so far?
Well, thank you very much. It's going great. It's been terrific. I mean, we premiered last night at Bay Street Theater, and we had two screenings in Southampton, and they all sold out, and the crowd was terrific and responded, and for us it means a lot. I mean, this community that we grew up right around the corner from the Sag Harbor Turnpike and went to Bridgehampton,
You went to that. You guys went to that school.
Yes, we did.
And was that team anything when, I mean, you know.
They were actually great when we were there. It was one of the real highest great times for the team. Troy Bowe, who played Division One, Daryl Hemby, Ronnie Golson, Julian Johnson, they were all playing for the team back then.
And as we met at a Hampton event the other night, and I said to you that, you know, just driving by that, I did not go to that school, but driving by it for all these years, I would see this sign that would say home of the, is the name of the team the Killer Bees?
It is now the Killer Bees. Actually, when we were there for a long time, they were known as the Bridgies, the Bridgehampton Bridgies.
So you'd see that. But they got their name Killer Bees because when they were winning the big title, the titles when we were there in the 80s, they play a very aggressive half-court full-press defense, and the reporter described them as swarming like a swarm of killer bees on defense, and that stuck.
So I'd see this sign for years, and it would say home of the you know, champion, division champion killer bees, and I'm going like, you know, it was just out of nowhere because there's a school that's there, you know, and you pass a lot of schools, you know, and I'm going, what is this team? There must be a story behind that. So obviously there is, and the movie tells the story. What made you want to tell the story?
It started with a Facebook thread from my classmate Ronnie Golson and Coach Carl, and they were kind of surprised nobody told this story already because it's such a good one.
You see Hoosiers and you go, this is just so...
They've been mentioned
or in... Hoop Dreams or any of those.
I forget what's the name of the book. A friend of ours got his MBA, and there's like the Science of Teams or something like that in the Bridgehampton School, and their team is mentioned. So everybody's known about it, but nobody made the movie. Nobody told the story yet, so figured...
Do we see a feature?
Time.
Maybe somebody will swoop in and buy your doc and want to turn it into Denzel as the coach.
It's entirely possible. I mean, you know, these conversations are easy to have because when you talk about a team that's done what they have, it's a little engine that could story. So it's full of hope and optimism despite all the long odds, you know, what these guys have accomplished.
And a predominantly black team in a generally white area that people think of as the Hamptons.
Yes.
And an extremely small class. It's like you drive by this high school and you think there's 1,000 or 2,000 kids in there.
Yeah.
And I think they had 12 kids graduate.
Yeah, they're in Class D. So Class D is 209 or something like that, 209 and fewer. So, like, the other Class D teams are Pearson and Shelter Island, and they have 200 kids in the high school. Bridgehampton has 40.
Pardon my ignorance. You mentioned a bunch of players, and I don't know this, but did any of those players make the NBA or go pro? Or?
They've never had a player go to the NBA.
They're usually undersized and quick. So they're often under, I mean, there are famous stories. Jerry Jones was a center back in the 70s. He was 5'9", and we just heard this story about when he jumped the opening tip against a 6'8 center. And the opening tip, the guy was looking at him like, you're kidding? And he won. Jerry Jones won the opening tip and dominated the guy all game. And there's a lot of stories about these guys doing it. It's amazing.
So they've been a contender and a championship team for many, many years.
Yeah.
Where do they get these? Are they just homegrown players?
The story of how the team got to be so good is very interesting. And this is what leads you into a little bit of a story about how there's a black community in Bridgehampton, which was during the Great Migration.
Talk about Azurest?
Because
there's a community that's an African-American community up by Sag Harbor called Azurest. Is that the community that you're talking about?
Very different.
Anyway, they came up mostly from...
Another movie, Neil.
North Carolina.
True story.
And, but when the migrant workers were up here, the kids had nowhere to stay for the day. And so there was a tragedy where two kids died in a fire and when they were just housed in a chicken coop during the day. So someone donated land that became the Bridgehampton Child Care Center. They put in a basketball court, and these kids spent 10 hours a day playing ball. And they're all, a lot of them are cousins and related, and so not only are they family, but they practice 10 hours a day, and there's no substitute.
And it's very competitive. Anybody who's played pickup basketball knows that if you want to keep playing, your team's got to win. As soon as you lose, you're off.
Yeah. So one generation would watch the next and wait. They wouldn't let them play until they were good enough. And, you know, their biggest thing in town would be to get on that court and be let in to play with the big players.
Now, if you can't see the movie out here, is it going to be shown somewhere on television or is it going to be picked up? I mean, it's a doc, which is a whole other conversation about marketing and selling a documentary.
Yes.
Do you have...
We are having some screenings. There's one next week as well, and some buyers are here, but with more buyers who are watching it. So hopefully, you know.
Where do you go with a documentary? I mean, is it like
a great market for documentaries now? I mean, it's not what it was 10 years ago. I mean, I remember hearing when
like HBO
had a hard time, and that's right. such a good movie.
Oh right. yeah.
Now, if you've got HBO, ESPN, Netflix,
Amazon.
How did you guys hook up with Shaquille O'Neal?
Glenn Furman, our executive producer, is friends with Shaq. He has an art foundation called the Flag Art Foundation, and Shaq curated some shows for him. Shaq does everything.
Shaq goes by Shaqasso.
Shaq in an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm?
Yeah. I think
in the
so.
Art world.
Yeah.
yeah.
And Larry
so
David
showed him
triple.
The film, and he wanted to jump in and help.
And be involved.
Oh, good.
So, yeah. Speaking of jumping in, tell me about filming the kids. How long did it take before they forgot that your cameras are there?
Not that long. I think kids today with their cell phones, every cell phone has a camera. All they're doing is filming each other all day long. I think it's a lot easier in this day and age than it was once upon a time.
It is more accepted, but that said, I would say also there are different kids. One, Elijah Jackson, is a wild extrovert. He's as soon as the camera comes, he's jumping in front of it, talking. He's inviting you home. He's come to my house. He wants to be in the movie, and he is in the movie a lot.
He's your JB Smoove.
Yeah, but JP, who's known as Pretty Boy, he is super quiet. He barely says two words to Coach Carl all year, let alone us. And you know, it took a little while longer to get his trust.
So quickly, the story arc of the film is a season, or is a what?
Yes,
right.
We follow them first practice until the last game.
And in
so
between,
that's
your way into this community where all kinds of issues of race and income inequality and gentrification are going on. So as you meet them and go home with them, and we interviewed also Fred Thiel, who's our assemblyman, about some of the political fights to close the school over the past, which were pretty intense. So anyway, it's a way.
It's definitely a part of the Hamptons that you haven't seen in Barbara Kopple or in any of the stories that have been told about any of the television series you see about the Hamptons out here. This is a very different look at it, and I encourage everyone to see it. And we hopefully will. It's going to get picked up here.
Yeah, thanks. And by the way,
that
if you want
great.
To see the trailer and know anything else, we got killerbeesmovie.com. You can check it out.
Yeah, sure. Terrific.
Well,
Oscar and Ben, thanks for joining us. Continued success. We will have you here next year when you'll have a new.
Yes, when you're
yeah.
here with the.
Yeah, maybe the hospital. Let's. What else in the Hamptons can we shoot? There's a hospital that's kind of dicey. We could go there. There's
the
restaurant.
Patch.
Yeah, the pumpkin.
There are a lot
patch.
Of restaurants with plenty of.
Corn Maze, the movie. Can I just pitch that to you? Corn Maze, the movie.
I think horror.
Right. The history of the pumpkin patch.
Right.
I think that's the
Pumpkin
that's
Town.
The
legendary story of Pumpkin Town.
So this was great, and part two next week.
Thanks to the 1770 House. Thanks to Frank PR. We've enjoyed our time here, and we'll see you next time. I'm Bill McCuddy.
I'm Bill Pergoli.
I'm Neil Rosen. Thanks for sitting around talking movies with us. And what do we do here every week, Bill?
We watch the bad movies so you don't have
and
to.
And here we're watching good movies, and we'll sit around talking movies with you at the Hampton Film Festival next weekend as well.